like a higher.
Changed the title of this a little bit last week here. Like condensed talks. The questions that I'll hand out in this are about the same. We'll try to address those. So how many people here have been to one of the previous sessions I've had this week?
That's exactly what people will do.
So I'll go through some the elementary parts with you. Went out every session so it stands alone.
Yeah,
if you've been to another one, they can't accumulate. So there are a lot of other local issues and, you know, history of fire in this region and so forth that are not included in this discussion today, because this is a very specific discussion focused on the American romance with trees or our romantic feelings about trees and the way in which that might be viewed, one perspective that can be taken by looking at the Christian perspective on the stewardship of creation, and not necessarily consistent with the popular culture, popular religion of trees, if you will. So let me give a little introduction of myself, and then we'll dive into the topic. For those of you who were in previous sessions, we'll have to go through the same little introduction here, but it's an important one. I grew up on a farm in Northern California, and that's an important part of the story because I grew up having to grow things and eat things on a farm. Not only vegetables, but animals, chickens, sheep, cows, pigs, and so forth. And that connection then with our food source was something that I never questioned, just grew up with it. Whereas today, when we have most of the U.S. population living in cities and suburbs and have no connection with the production process for our sustenance, then those things are out of sight, out of mind. And the same thing happens with forests. So I went from high school into community college and got an interest in, I had an interest in forestry in high school. And then repaired my rather miserable high school record in community college, and then went on to the University of California, Berkeley, and did exceptionally well there after I grew up a little bit. Worked in the forest products industry for several years and decided in the 1960s that what the industry had done to the Redwood region was not necessarily consistent with my professional outlook on life. So the land was pretty beat up, and so were the people that were left behind. So I went back to school to study the relationship between people and forests, and no one was doing that at the time. So I studied social philosophy at Yale and combined that with systems ecology. For those of you who study philosophy, I studied phenomenology and existentialism, which are arcane really part of philosophy, and took a couple of good courses in the philosophy of religion. And then Yale hired a sociologist in its forestry school, the first sociologist to start that integration. And I got started in that, went back to Berkeley for a PhD, and then for the rest of my career, been combining sociology and forestry, looking at ecosystems. So that career, which lasted about almost, if you think about how much experience I have in summer employment, professional employment, and so forth, about 50 years of forestry. And at the end of these 50 years, about 10 years ago, I got increasingly concerned about the fact that we aren't really able to have a successful conversation about forests in society at large. And it's because we have begun to talk about our forests in terms of essentially religious terms. And there's very little, when people get basic beliefs fixed in their mind, there's very little room for dialogue and exchange. It's, you're wrong. You're not one of us. You're outside the moral community of acceptable thinking. So that troubled me enough that I began to read in theology and religion. Have two sabbatical experiences, one in Asia and Japan, We gotta look at the way people in Asia look at their forests, and in Japan you can't see very much about how they treat their forests until you see it through the eyes of the Buddhist and Shinto religions. And they have very different approaches historically. Increasingly, Japan is forced into a global economy and has to begin to practice the kind of short-term economic rationalism that we do here, because international banks and lending institutions have coerced them into that. But historically, people approach their forests through some much broader sets of beliefs, and this country is no exception to that, and the value of a foreign sabbatical experience was to come back home and say, yeah, we've got religion here too, popular religion of forests. So then I began to study that and study more formal aspects of religion. So I put together here, you'll see a little theological statement, and the basic ecological paradox that we as humans share, that we can't live without taking from life. And it's stated here rather poetically, and you can read this on your own, by an Eastern Orthodox priest. And I've added a little bit to that in the sense that just as we were freed from ultimate, controlled by powers and so forth of the world by Christ's sacrifice, by Christ's death, then we, in that sense, also live because other things die. And this is a life process. And we need to explore that in greater depth and look at stewardship through the question of the crucifixion and what this was really all about and Christ's love. And that is a very difficult topic to tie into, and I'm not necessarily the best person to do it. I know I'm not the best person to do it in terms of theology. I think I'm pretty good at it in terms of forestry, making the connections to the forestry side. That's what you're going to hear some of today, or we will discuss today. So what we'll try to do is work through questions, and then I'll give a little bit of my own personal history rather than to simply preach. I will preach to myself and give a little bit of my own personal history and how I went through changes that led me to a very different perspective. And then we'll look at the whole question of how the dilemma, the paradox that we face in regard to all of nature, but specifically today with regard to forests, that we can't live without taking life from something else and hopefully renewing that life. That can't be addressed unless we get to some basic questions of what is our set of responsibilities, how do we define those responsibilities, and what does the cross or Jesus have to do with it. So, the first question, why do Americans, really, lead the world? We lead the world in both protection of forests and consumption of wood products. So we have, if you look at data you can get from the Food and Agriculture Association of the UN, and it's Food and Agriculture Organization, what it is, of the UN, and look at those data, and then you look at our internal data as to the land we have set aside and the amount of wood we actually produce. This country has vast forests which remain untouched by and large. We've set them aside on national forests, on national parks, on wilderness areas, and many of the state lands. So the U.S. is actually growing one-third more wood than it harvests annually. So there's, in addition to that, a net accumulation of the biomass in trees in forests of the U.S. So of all the countries in the world, we do the best job of saving our forests. At the same time, we lead the world in the per capita consumption of wood, and we have, over the last 20 years, become substantial importers, net importers of wood, with almost 30% of the softwood lumber that's consumed for housing and so forth comes from other countries. And just as in many of other resource procurement policies, oil and minerals and so forth, we increasingly turn to other countries to supply our needs. So why is this? Why do we carry this strange contradiction? Do you have any guesses?
Yes.
Well, part of it has to do with sprawl. We build our houses out of wood. And we build more and more and more and more. If you go to Europe, they don't have sprawl. They build houses out of stone or...
Yeah, well, that's part of why we have big demand. But why this contradiction? Why do we carry that contradiction?
We don't see it as a contradiction.
We don't see it as a contradiction.
No, because for all intents and purposes, the people who are building houses don't realize that we're importing wood to build it.
So we don't know about it. That's what you're saying. We're not aware.
Yeah. I would say it has to do with wealth. I mean, forests are beautiful things. Who doesn't like forests? Who doesn't want a big house? We can afford to have both, and so we do.
Wealth, consumption, that doesn't consider where things come from. Wealth, consumption. Why that contradiction in our culture?
Well, I think there's also that not in my backyard idea that, you know, it can happen somewhere else, and as long as I don't see it and it's not my immediate thing, then I can not...
Yeah. Out of sight, out of mind.
Yeah. Out of sight, out of mind, not in my backyard. And so it's, if it's out of sight, it is literally out of mind. Our collective
right.
mind is not one. You don't hear this on television talk shows, news reports. You won't read it in the newspaper. It's one of those things which is a fact, indisputable fact, that we won't want to pay much attention to. Yeah.
How about just general commercialism? You wipe out a resource and you also wipe out your job. So you want to carry it forward. You want to have a renewable resource to work with.
Yeah, that's part of why people want to do wood production, but it doesn't really explain why we carry this strange contradiction. And that's what's really we want to look at today is the fact that we have two minds. We want all these trees preserved out here, and yet we want all this wood. Yeah.
But yes. I'm thinking about our identity as a country connected to the American dream. You think about what's the American dream? Well, partly it seems like it's rooted in this idea of conquest and wildness. Like there's this rugged individualism at the heart of the American dream. I'm going to pull myself up by my bootstraps, and that's tied to, you know, the whole way that we came into this continent and explored and exploited. And at the same time, that's tied to wanting my own acreage, my own house. You know, I'm not going to live in an apartment building with a bunch of other people. I want my own house. So there's this weird sort of paradox in our identity as a country that point in these different directions.
Yeah, so one thing I heard you saying was highly individualistic.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can see that not in my backyard, and you get this last settler syndrome and people moving to the urban fringe where they want to live there, but they don't want the next person to build on the next lot, the Johnny lot. So we're a highly individualistic culture.
Well, like we have friends who bought in this huge cul-de-sac community in Puyallup, and they were so excited to tell us that out of their back window they looked down at wetlands and trees. But like for miles on either side of them, they're just house. You know, so there's a little bit of that paradox.
Yeah.
The point I was going to take was you said one third, and if you go back to the 70s, we were importing one third of the oil or something like that.
Right.
And when we get the number up to 65% importing lumber, I wonder if we'll change our mind.
Yeah.
And the governor will have to say, the president will have to say, well, now's the time to start cutting down our forests.
Yeah, well, we'll talk a little bit about that.
I think some of it at this point in time is purely economic. If we can get our wood cheaper somewhere else where we don't care how they get it. If we want to regulate, if we want things done, you know, say our forest the way we want it done, it's much more expensive to do it in our own backyard.
Right, and it's, again, the economic is individualistic. It's consumer-driven, and it's consumer tastes that are created by the people, the producers, and the corporations that develop this. And so, common theme here is highly individualistic culture, not considering things that are beyond. Yeah, one more question.
Well, I back up because maybe I misunderstood.
Sure.
But did you say we produce a third more than we actually need?
We grow a third more than we actually harvest in this country. So, and then we import one third of what we use.
A third more of what we actually harvest.
Right. Yeah. So we have every year is a net accumulation.
So we have more than we need.
We have an abundance.
So because we have more than we need, we have the capability of then preserving the rest of the
forest.
If we import it.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah. Say we want the forests here to be kept wild.
So we import.
And so to get the wood we need, we import it.
Okay.
Right. You don't care if Canada's wild or not.
Do you mean that a third of what the total, let's say it's a billion board feet in the U.S., and there's a third more that's grown every year?
Yeah, if we look at what you extract in logging out of the forest every year, okay?
Okay.
That much grows back plus one third more.
Okay, not a third of your gross volume.
No, it's what we log is replaced plus a third more. So we're accumulating more and more wood, standing wood in the U.S., which, by the way, I don't want to get too far because we've got some other things to go to here. The U.S. is arguing in terms of global climate regulation because they're saying, look, we're storing carbon. We need to be credited for storing all this carbon in trees. So part of the value of preserving all these forests is keeping that carbon in fixed organic form rather than and you want that credit against our big oil consumption where we put a lot of carbon in the atmosphere. So there's a very interesting relationship there, but we've got a pretty good idea of some of the contradictions here. Let's move along to the next question. Because at root here is that we don't really think about the fact, we don't want to think about the fact that we are using all this material and getting it from other places. We are not connected with how that stuff grows, harvested, so forth. It just arrives to us. So there's an amazing contradiction in our minds where, you know, that's why I say it's sort of an out-of-body experience. We consume, we don't know where it comes from, and we really don't want to know that. We don't want to know when we see a clear cut that that's where our house came from. That is taboo thinking. Yeah.
But because of this contradiction, we don't see the clear cut because it's actually on another continent.
Except in our clear cuts, we see them and we then are horrified by them and we don't recognize that that clear cut was done to build homes. And that connection is not made. It's ugly. But we don't see it as part of our human sustenance activity. So the clear cut is bad, and we don't even think about it. Making that connection again, tying
this
emotion.
This is not only about forts.
No, it's agriculture, it's mines,
right
out your door here.
It's petroleum, it's all of these things we don't connect.
Exactly. We don't connect. So that's the big problem that I see. So how can we learn then to take responsibility? And I think that the Christian community has something to say about that. So what people say, well, let's just consume less. I'll build a smaller house. I'll recycle my paper. We will do a number of other things that make us better, more green consumers. And yet, that will work a bit, but it's not going to be the whole answer. There's too many people in this country. The population continues to grow with immigration. And the per capita consumption is actually pretty steady with an increase, but as population increases and consumption increases, total consumption. And the question is, can we really do anything about this and the scale that would need to be done without thinking about why we protect all these forests? Why we have said that most of our national forests will be off limits to harvesting trees? And that's a really controversial question to raise. Because these days, general thinking is we want to keep our national forests free from forest harvesting. We're not talking about national parks.
We're not talking about wilderness areas. We're talking about lands that millions and millions, 270 million acres in the United States, that's in national forests, about 200 million of which would be open to potential production of wood products. And yet, the general opinion is of a lot of people in this country that trees are very valuable. They're symbols of life. We have a strong sense of reverence for trees. It's okay for industry here and there to cut land on, cut trees on their own land, but we don't want it on the public land. So we'll import those trees from somewhere else off somebody else's land. That is a very interesting contradiction in our thinking, and so it gets to the whole question of what this romantic attachment to trees is that's developed at the end of the 20th century. It's not new. I mean, every culture you can go through, tree is an important symbol. And the tree of life is not unique to the Christian or Hebrew tradition. It's found in all kinds of cultures. So trees have been symbolic to people throughout all of recorded history and myths and stories that they've people have passed along from pre-recorded, pre-written history. And we, in the late 20th century, simply gave birth to some of our own stories about why these forests are important. And the difficult question for a forestry professional is that how do you go about working with these forests, managing them, if they're seen as sacred, off limits? Not individual trees, but whole vast hundreds of millions of acres. That's the problem. And there's the very practical reasons why that is a serious problem. And one is right outside the door here. It has to do with the fact that forests, particularly in the western U.S., that were subject to periodic wildfires in the pre-European times, were much more open. Trees were scattered about, and fires burned less intensively. They would burn across the ground, and once in a while they'd blow up and take out whole trees and patches of trees, but you didn't get these massive fires that would take out whole forests. That was only true in certain places where you had forests that would burn every 100 to 150, 200 years in that way. Western Washington was sort of burned that way. Yellowstone burned that way. But most outside the door here, most of these forests would have been far more open, periodic fires, and then without fire for the last 100 years. So we thought it's a bad thing to have fire in the forest, so we kept it out for 100 years, very successfully in most cases. All these young trees have grown in. So you get, you look outside the door here, big old trees out, there was fir growing outside the door, and then historically, some of the Douglas fir would have grown in here and there. The fire would come and grow, knock out most of those, burn them up. Maybe one would survive and become a big tree in the future. And today what we have after 100 years is we've got a tangled mess. There's all kinds of trees, and then we've got dead wood on the ground. And when a fire goes through this today, the whole thing burns. The trees that have been there for 250 years burn and are killed. All the young trees are killed, and then this happens not across the whole landscape. Some patches don't get burned as intensely as others, but you get massive, big patches that are, take out everything. And then you have 100, 200 years for forests to get back in.
And logging is part of the solution to that.
Exactly.
If you log it on a regular basis, it doesn't build up all.
And that's the big dilemma, because you've got to go in and cut out some of these trees to open it up so you can put fire back in there to restore the natural process. But the fact that people have this attachment to trees and reverence for trees means that politically, forestry professionals have been blocked and they can't go into the natural forest and cut out those trees.
So you're burning up a resource rather than cutting it and using it.
Exactly. But that's exactly the case, which then burning it up contributes carbon to the atmosphere, which worsens the carbon accumulation and climate change problems. So we burn more forests in the West every year than we harvest on the public lands.
important fact. We burn far more wood, goes up in smoke, into carbon in the atmosphere, than we harvest on the public lands.
That's okay.
And that, and the real question, the dilemma for professionals is we know that biologically that's not good. It's not just people wanting to help the industry. It's biologically it's not good for the forest because this tangled mess is not natural. These trees get crowded and sink in here and they die. Too many trees, they not enough water to support them. Bugs get into them, kill the trees, and you look across the slope there and you see lots of dead trees. That's not a natural forest when you define natural as pre-European. So, what is our problem? Our problem is we have to, as a people, begin to think about our attachment to trees and whether, in some circumstances, not on a big scale, but in some circumstances, we're going to have to cut trees to meet our own needs, to restore forests to a more natural condition, so forth. Yes, question.
I just wanted to insert a comment here, which you might find interesting, particularly. I recently graduated from UC Berkeley.
Okay.
And we've been having a big controversy over the last year, at least, over some oaks near the present stadium, the football
right.
stadium. And I think these oaks are about 80 years old, 80
right.
to 100 years old. I believe they were planted by the university.
Right.
And the university is right now trying to get together the funds and also the public support to build a new stadium because the current one is directly over the fault.
The Hayward Fault.
And it also doesn't have the space necessary for most of the female athletes at the university. So that it actually is part of a sort of an inequitable structure at the university. And for the past year at least, a group of students have been occupying the oaks and preventing them from being cut down. The university had been planning to replace those trees, I mean, to plant new ones and even to plant more in the site. And I think you can tell that it has very good reasons for wanting to remove them. Nevertheless, those tree sitters, to my knowledge, remain there. And it just causes huge controversy in the community, especially in the environmental community. And it became this really blasphemous thing to say, no, those trees need to go. I was absolutely horrified by the reverence and the worship. I would even say the worship of these trees. I've had this personal experience that's really
It's
really shocked me. So
actually, if you go back 100 years, there's literature on various peoples of the world, the early cults in the Middle East and so forth, and it was referred to there, in terms of idolatry and impotence. Not just trees, rocks, springs, all kinds of places, which were worshipped. Now, that kind of reverence, in terms of individual trees, is just a small scale issue of what's now happening on a vast landscape and regional scale in terms of particularly the national forests, which are owned and administered by the U.S. government.
And at the same time, like these tree sitters, what? They use toilet paper, right? They live in houses.
The environmental community, the more radical members of the environmental community who've been able to shape the public agenda argue that it's natural for the forest to burn and that burns are good. The problem is if you have burns in these kinds of crowded dying forests, there's nothing very natural about that burn. And that's the big dilemma. So let's move along to the whole question of what is at the root of that very attachment. It's really romanticism. That's what I've been able to, my research and others have done this sort of thing. It's romantic. And what is romanticism? Where does it come from? Well, it's a movement out of England, Germany, late 19th century. And romanticism, first of all, is highly individualistic. Of course, the most important thing to understand, it is individualistic, and so it fits very well with our dominant culture, economic culture, political culture. And it has to do with an experience of the sublime. I had someone teaching here last week talking about the sublime, which is a sense of a personal feeling of passion that's aroused by some external object. And so in the U.S., waterfalls of Yosemite,
Most of the national parks, Yellowstone, inspired this kind of awe, wonder, and sense of passion in people. And then it was extended to big buildings, Chrysler Tower, on and on and on, all kinds of objects which inspire this sense of our smallness in the face of the greatness and wonderfulness of nature and our individual feelings. And it's also based on aesthetics. We view things, we look. And in looking at things, we don't necessarily have a relationship. And you think of the Romantic movement, it wasn't necessarily people had a relationship to these objects they were appreciating when they go to Niagara Falls. They weren't necessarily, even when they went to some of the national parks, it was viewing. Backpacking is a much more modern kind of thing. In research I've done, where we've taken and had laid out a map of a watershed, for instance, an area maybe several thousands of acres, and asked people in sociological research, what's important to you in this watershed? And you ask people who are kayakers, they'll say, well, we put our kayaks in here, we've got some big stumps down here we have to look out for, we take out down here, we want you to worry about those things when you do your planning. You know, and ask somebody else, a hunter, they've got their favorite hunting place and so forth. If you ask people who are more romantic about it, they'll say the whole thing. But what specifically? Just the whole thing. But we need to know more than that. Well, we can't give you any information. So you end up with this blank. You can't represent those people in a concrete sense of relationship to land. Because it's a vague sentiment, it's a feeling of reverence for that place. And it's not based on use. If they were backpackers to the wilderness, they'd say, yeah, I love that lake. And this is the best overlook in the Cascades or whatever. So it's romanticism has been the basis for this reverence for trees, and the sublime is the experience that has motivated that. And it's not unrelated, as I'll show a little bit, as I'll discuss a little bit, to what Price said. And one of the things to think about before we get to the end of this is, well, why was Jesus always talking about healing the blind? What's so important about healing the blind? Well, if you read that carefully, these people were looking, they weren't seeing. They weren't understanding. They weren't understanding their relationships to God, to other people. In this case, we'd say to nature. And looking without seeing is quite characteristic, I think, of the Romantic movement, an aesthetic movement. So we want to today talk about unmasking Romanticism. And I've taken some of this from Paul, and whether Paul wrote Colossians or not, I don't know. It's debatable. But it at least represents some of his thinking, and it's consistent with what you find in other places. But it's particularly clear in chapter 3, 9. Do not lie to one another, seeing that you have stripped off the old self with its practices and have clothed yourselves in the new self, which is being renewed in knowledge according to the image of its creator. In that renewal, there is no longer Greek or Jew, circumcised or uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian, slave or free, but Christ is all and in all. It's the old, losing the old, and moving on to the new. And that's, when I talk about unmasking Romanticism, we're talking about casting off the old. I mean, I've read some of Walter Wink, and Walter Wink saying, yeah, Romanticism is an important step toward restoring our relationships with other people, with creation. But it's only the first step. We've got to get beyond that and start looking more deeply at renewal, at the new self. And I'll briefly tell a very personal story, because this is what happened to me over the last 15 years, approximately that time. But that was an unmasking of my career. And led me to where I am now in terms of looking at religion. Academics, and I was a superb, I had perhaps the best education you could get at the time. I was really privileged to once I learned how to study. I'm a graduate degree from Berkeley and a master's from Yale, PhD at Berkeley. At times when those places were really doing their very best, and I think in many ways that was the golden age of Berkeley. So I became an excellent scientist. I had a tremendous reputation, and went on to develop international recognition for my work. Invited to speak all over the place, lots of research money. Slated to become a dean. I was on the not the fast track, but working my way through there. I would become a forestry dean somewhere, and all the old boys were had their eye on me. We're cultivating me. And, but you have to understand a little bit about the academic ego. And I'm not too hard on any academics in here. But to survive in the academic community, your ego is most important. You've got to build your reputation. And it doesn't really, in many ways, it doesn't matter. What it contributes to people's lives in terms of your success and advancement, what matters is that people see you as an expert in your field. And so there's this hyper-individualization where each person develops a niche and makes that niche known so that everybody else can see it and respect it. And then you get published more papers, you get more research money, you get promoted, you get a bigger salary, you get invited to speak in international conventions, and it feeds your ego. One reason that women have not historically done so well in academia is they don't need as many medals on their chest to feel good. Men, we're like old soldiers, where the more medals we can put on our chest, the better we feel about ourselves. And it's really, relationships are less important. So I was doing real well. And then along came the, in 1990 and through 93, the decisions that we would take the national forests of the Pacific Northwest and reduce the timber harvests on those forests from about 4.6 billion board feet per year down to less than 200 million. And this meant the dislocation of lots of loggers, sawmill workers, massive unemployment, all the problems that follow from that. And having studied these communities for 15 years and understanding the culture, I had a real moral dilemma. Because the climate of the time and the climate of opinion that was created under the Clinton administration and the plan that President Clinton put together, at least under the direction of his office, that provided a Northwest Forest Plan to reduce the timber harvest that much in this region. That plan was not necessarily governed by science, it was politics. And the key concern was to respond to the perception that if these old forests, these natural forests, were to be logged, they'd be gone forever, and we needed to do our very best to preserve as much as possible. Now, scientifically, there was no basis for that. That was the politics, and it was based on the reverence for trees. And yet, there were a number of other options that could have been used to slow down. In 10 years, you could have weaned off most people, and it would have had much less impact on individual lives, on communities, and economies, and so forth. But it was chopped off overnight. So I decided in a way, I felt I had no choice. I had to speak out, and not as a personal opinion at the time, but as a professional to say, well, you need to understand the culture of the people, their way of life. And so I, as a social scientist, just represented what I'd learned and what others had learned about logging culture and sawmill culture. And loggers were occupationally mobile. They moved around. They weren't necessarily attached to a given place based on hard work and so forth. And in exposing that culture, making it known, in the face of a view that the logger was the destroyer of the forest and ought to be removed, that was about as politically incorrect as I could be.
Yeah.
that was, I'll use any crude terms here, but it was professional suicide. It was good social science, based on when we had workshops where we compared what was happening to loggers with farm workers, farmers in the farm crisis, with steel workers, even with Soviets that were displaced when the communism fell. We found the same consequences in all things: family collapse, abandonment of elders, spousal abuse, youth problems, and on and on and on. And we just documented all. Well, that, to document that was to make these people human, and to make them human was to fly right in the face of people who wanted the trees preserved because they were sacred. So, I wrote a book, finally, in reaction to this, because I had been invited to testify to the president beyond the plan for developing the forests, and when the loggers finally were referred to as timber junkies, I had it. And I wrote to the president and said, "So long, folks, I'm out of here." And why? And that was a kiss of death. I've been bringing in about $500,000 a year of research funds, and it dropped to zero. And I spent the rest of my career teaching, well, doing the best teaching that I'd ever done, but not much on the research. So what was that? Well, in some ways, I look back on it, I was called to answer to a human concern. You know, I wasn't anti-protection of old growth trees where they're spectacular and beautiful. I think we want to protect all the redwoods and other strong sentiments. What it was a sense that there was something fundamentally morally wrong in crushing people, in vilifying people, to take job loss and compound it with vilification, to where these people were absolutely humiliated. So in speaking out, in many ways, where I felt, as I look back on it now, that the Holy Spirit was saying to me, "Your career is a sham. You know, yes, you're successful, but you're not getting at the truth. All these great things you've done, the papers you've published, and the places you've spoken, don't count for that much when it comes right down to the end of things. What matters is the quality of relationship." And that's the way I see it now. And at the time, I just felt I was pulled. I had to do it. I knew it was suicidal. I knew it was professional annihilation, but I had to do it. So I did it. And I relieved myself of a huge burden and felt free afterwards. I still don't care. I was doing what I love to do. That's the way it is. So as we think then, I think that is a micro case of how we think about our relationship to forests in terms of a romantic vision. Collectively, we're not going to live successfully with the earth unless we go through an unmasking of our romantic attachments to the earth. Too many people in the world, too many impacts. We can't simply say this stuff has to be kept off limits, not touched, pure. We have to learn how to work with nature in a very practical way so that we perpetuate it, sustain it, at the same time meet our needs, and then most importantly meet the needs of other people in the world, both now and in the future. And that's a big order, and we don't know how to do it. But that question's not been asked. Instead, we, in terms of forests at least, we've been stuck in this impasse of romantic attachments to the trees and an inability to move forward. So that leads us to where I wanted to bring this together, but before I do that, I want to have any questions for me personally for this issue before I move toward some of the discussion of how unmasking might be done. Yes.
Well, I guess it kind of has to do with the romantic image of how we hold the forest, but you know, for me, it's a trust issue. And I think this gentleman back here was talking about growing up and all the clear cutting that happened in Colorado, and you know, and how that, and you said that was a mistake.
Right.
But to me, there's something about the power that comes with I'm in charge of deciding what is enough or how much is good. Who's making those decisions, and how easy is it to get out of the balance that's, I think, important. So it's an issue of trust of, okay, well, if I say, I understand the bigger need that we all need to do some cutting, who's making those decisions, and could greed be an influence in how those decisions are made? And there seems to be a prior history to that happening. So that's...
Yeah, so there's lack of trust because of past practices, and we can think of that in not just a societal sense, but if you've had broken relationships with other people,
absolutely,
you can't go forward.
Absolutely.
You're stuck. And yeah. So the question is, what do we do when we're faced with that kind of an impasse,
right,
where trust has broken down?
Right.
Well, you can't, my experience with that in terms of professional activities, you can push all you want. You're never going to get there unless you reframe the whole thing in some new way. You've got to come up with a whole new frame that brings people together on a new footing. And there may be other political ways of doing that. What I'm talking about today is how does that get framed in terms of Christian thought? Or unmasking, what I think Paul was really talking about, is that Jesus freed us from those powers that are in contention, whether it's the power of greed, the power of aggressive politics, the power of romance of trees, all those powers, we get freed and set on a new footing. That's what I understand as I read through the writings of Paul in terms of the significance of Christ, the crucifixion, and the resurrection. And that's, to me, a frame that has a lot of secular meaning that's never even put in religious terms. There are frames that will work, and I think the Christian community can make a contribution, not necessarily always in terms of Christian ethics, but in understanding that we have to become new, or we're going to be stuck. And all we're going to do is go further downhill with more and more carbon in the atmosphere, more forest burning, more mad people. So how do we get to the new? That's our challenge. And that's what, I mean, that's why I told the personal story, is I got dumped into the new, almost pulled into the new without my, wrenching, and yet enjoyable in some strange, perverse way. It was, well, I'm free from all that. I don't have to worry about all that anymore. And I think that is what we'll all find if we can come into a dialogue and a new way of thinking. Yes.
You may be talking about this as you go into the unmasking of the romance portion, but masks are, for Luther, ways of understanding God.
Okay.
That God is hidden. You might say that behind the tree, the mask that we see, the tree is a God.
Yeah.
And this this hidden God chooses to be hidden behind creation. And we do think that, at least Luther thoughts, talked about God being behind. And if you use that thought of unmasking the ruins of the trees, you might be just trying to say, what's behind the tree? And then also you would want to know what's behind the human being and the human communities that are using trees or caring for trees. And
that's a really good point, and I'm not a student of Luther. So again, I'm self-trained in theology, so I haven't got a lot of Luther, so I'm glad you raised it.
And I can't say much more about that.
But I think the real dilemma there is when you say, well, God is behind trees, then the question of what keeps us from then saying, well, trees are then a true icon, and as a true icon are sacred objects. As a Russian icon would be, or something else. And that's where, you know, how do we live if nature is all iconic for us in that sense? Yes, I think, argue for immanence, incarnation in nature of God.
Well,
I happily actually wants to go along with that. But then the dilemma is, how do we live?
Well, one thing, I think, takes away the idolatry of a tree. And it puts me and the tree in relation to God.
Okay.
And not just the tree alone, but every other aspect of community, including the logger, the trucker, the cafe owner, that they too are Christ for me.
Okay. That is a productive path we might want to
travel
down.
It just seems like the equation is different. If it's all simply utilitarian objects or things that I think give me life, things don't give life. Only the Creator gives life.
Okay.
And it establishes a new orientation, and I'll go to Bonhoeffer and I'll throw this out because it's my favorite thing to say in these conversations, and that is, Jesus mediates relationship. I need him to stand between you and me. Otherwise, we're in tension. We're in this kind of ego struggle or victimization, and what happens in Jesus is that he mediates love.
Okay.
A kind of being in community that is different than if you're just simply talking about capitalism, romanticism. We're talking about Christ mediating life.
Right. Oh, I am with you on that. And unmasking romanticism, I've opened a door. All I'm looking for are answers. I don't know the answers, and I'm turning to you and others to ask that question. We take that mask off, and our sentimental attachment, individualistic sentimental attachment to trees based on experience of the sublime, and what do we find when we take the mask off? Is it chaos or not? And you say, no, it's something else. It's God and Jesus as mediator.
I think we can really understand the mask behind the tree, that God is the creator of all things, until we come to the cross and death and the fact that in failure, Jesus journeys and lives and enters into all of that dark evil caused by human communities. And find that there God gives life. And when you begin at the worst place and you're taught the lesson of grace, then I think you begin to see the tree differently. I think somehow that would give you courage to leave your job and leave your career and strike out in a more loving fashion. Because you find that in the weakness of things, God is present. That's kind of where I feel like...
I'm happy you said that. There's many ways of following right along with the story I've been trying to lay out here. You've just taken it the next step based on your understanding of Luther. And in my reading of the Eastern Christian Orthodox literature, and far more incarnational views of nature, it's there as well. And I actually, I was participating in the first Earth Day at Berkeley in 1970. And we went into a big auditorium there when Margaret Mead spoke, and then Ellen Watts spoke. Remember Ellen Watts, those of you who are a little older, was an Episcopal priest who became a Buddhist, and he was in his full Buddhist days there. He got up in front of 2,000 people and said, "We're not going to learn to live on the earth until we learn how to die." Turned off the lights and left us for 5 minutes. And it's the most powerful lecture I've ever heard. No, really, we had to sit with our own mortality and say, yes, what does that mean? And we got that Zen moment. It came through loud and clear, even to those who didn't understand much of the Zen. And I think you're right in saying that to go to the ugliest. The other day I gave had a talk and led a discussion on clear cuts. And the fact that the ugliness of the clear cut has something to do with the cross. In that something has been given up, there has been death, what is going to come next? What opening is this? And it was based on, for those of you who were part of all that, the idea that certain trees won't grow unless you have openings for them. That means that clear cut of some size, and I don't know, we're advocating big clear cuts. But if we live with nature, then we have to see that as something that we can wrap into that same incarnational view. And at times there is death, and that's just what humans do. But we can also find Christ in that if we act with responsible stewardship toward ourselves, others, and the whole creation. Disturbing is what we are as human biological creatures. We are disturbers, and we're not gods. We don't transcend our bodies. That's what today was all about. We don't transcend our bodies. We are located in our bodies. In that sense, we're not godlike and transcendent in terms of we have to live together.
I think going back to sort of the Lutheran themes, that Christology is important, the sacraments are important too, and that the moment of death for a Christian is remembered every day in your baptism.
Okay.
That there's a kind of spending moments or acknowledging in your identity that you have died and you're joined with Jesus in death. That's what baptism, Paul says. We're joined with Jesus in death, and as Christ was raised from the dead, we too might be raised. And so this daily dying, or the being a Christian, is a, I think they call it a paradox, that you will mark your death and your life at the same moment, at the moment of your baptism.
Right.
And it's kind of like the clear cut. When you remember your baptism, you're kind of like clear-cutted. You die.
Yeah.
But
something new comes.
Your new life,
yeah.
The new you, the new creation is everything.
Yeah. And the importance of that, and is everybody tracking on this and the other contributions? Because I want to pull this together in closure here. That was an important statement. Yes.
I just want to point to the danger, though, of talking about the cross in this way as a resurrection out of it, but at the same time, we don't seek to create crosses in the world.
Right.
Exactly.
We don't seek to create evil so that resurrection can happen.
Yeah, yeah.
It happens by God's grace out of the evil that shouldn't have happened in the first place.
Right. This is the kind of conversation we need to have when we unmask it, because then it opens up all kinds of directions we could travel in, and some of them could be fraught with danger.
Sure.
And we need to make sure it's coherent. That's what theology is about. And my role here is not to do theology. My role is to set some questions for those of you who are more informed in theology, so you can teach me and hopefully carry on conversations that will take us beyond these romantic notions. Because so much of popular discourse is simply sentimental romanticism. And getting opening the door to something beyond that and to what that new is a direction I think we need to go in. And I'm not leading it, that what those new frames are. To make that very clear. I'm here to set the forestry problems and to say it's connected to religion. And I can see that clearly, yes.
I have a practical question, and that's how do we as individuals get involved in advocating more responsible logging in this country? How do we prevent more trees from going up in smoke and also prevent our appetite for wood from relying on imports from other countries?
Let's say if you're a member of a congregation somewhere, set up some adult forums. Bring in people from the various perspectives, raise these questions, get discussions going, and then, because it's not, the professionals are locked in absolute conflict. And there are conflict industries that have developed that perpetuate, and people have jobs to feed off of the conflict. So it's not going to get solved there. It's going to be solved when citizens beyond that begin to have conversations. And then you take those conversations to others and try to break those deadlocks and open some windows to something new.
So you mean writing letters to elected officials?
Yeah, but not just saying, I want you to protect these trees, but hey, the whole frame is wrong. And enough people, what is it that politicians say? If they get five letters that are on the same topic within a week or two, it goes on their agenda as an issue. So if you got enough people talking like this, writing letters, saying we need a new frame and this is a suggestion of a new way of thinking, you start getting attention. But you're not, if you just stay within the existing frames and try to influence lobbyists, forget it. All you do is feed the conflict industry. Yeah.
A lot of this discussion is way over my head.
Yeah.
But practically speaking, and from your forestry professional viewpoint, do most of the forestry professionals in our country now think that we need to stop trying to prevent fires and just let nature take its course, which would then open up more? No. Okay.
No, I've been on a couple of committees, and it's been a number of years ago, but the consensus of forestry professionals is we need to manipulate these forests, like going in and taking out trees and then reintroducing fire. It's not natural to let it burn. If you, how many people know Sequoia National Park? Great, big, beautiful, gigantic, it's like Sequoia Gigantea. They're crowded by this. And if that forest burns, you're burning trees that are thousands of years old. And that is a crime. So they're in there, in a national park, cutting trees and reintroducing fire.
Can't the loggers come in and cut those trees? I mean,
they hire a local logger, but they do it under very carefully regulated conditions. And that's the only way to save those trees. Otherwise, ultimately, a big fire will kill them all. Or most of them. And that's the same with these big, beautiful Douglas firs you see out the window here. Same thing will happen here unless something is done to remove the understory fuels. So these are complex topics in forestry. They're more complex, I think, in religion. I get tired of fighting the same old war, so I try to move to something new. I was drawn into something new, and my career came to a radical shift that led me to start asking questions about religion and theology. And I've brought you to where I am, at least, in terms of unmasking my attempt to say, let's unmask romanticism, and I don't know where that, opening that door leads. That's those of you who are informed about that. Teach me, or start teaching one another so we get a new frame developed. So that's all I have to say today.